Hey, thanks for the download button on the family-friendly version of the Steve Austin Show. And thanks for supporting the sponsors of this podcast because they're the ones who let me open up two cans of Audio Whoop Ass for you every single week for free. And that includes DDP and DDP Yoga. The holidays are right around the corner, people. And I know how hard it is at this time of year to stick to your regular workout routine and diet. You're busier, so getting to the gym is tougher. You're surrounded by all kinds of food and cookie and baked goods, so sticking to your healthy eating plan is tougher too. Well, DDP Yoga can help with that. It's a 30-minute workout you can do right in your own home. It's also a great gift idea for anyone who's looking for a little extra workout motivation. Just ask Jake the Snake Roberts. He had an incredible career. He let his wrestling and psychology speak for him in the ring, and the only thing that derailed his pro wrestling run was his own personal demons. Jake's troubles are well documented, and you hear me talk about his pro wrestling lifestyle a lot on this podcast and all the boys that we lost way too soon. I know a lot of us thought we were going to lose Jake the same way. Luckily, Jake found a miracle in the form of his former student and friend, Diamond Dallas Page. Dallas and director Steve Yu brought Jake to Atlanta and documented him as they struggled with health issues, emotional issues, and repairing his family life. They helped him reclaim his career and his life. Jake's journey took a little under 3 years, and you can see it in the new documentary, The Resurrection of Jake the Snake. DDP Yoga worked wonders for Jake the Snake, and it can do the same for you. And if DDP Yoga has already changed your life, share your story on Twitter. Tweet your story to @podcast1 and use the hashtag Steve Austin. You'll have a chance to win a DDP Yoga program signed by the one and only Diamond Dallas Page. So tweet in your DDP Yoga story to @podcast1 and use the hashtag Steve Austin for your chance to win an autographed DDP Yoga program. And it's not too late to make your own DDP Yoga story. DDP is giving you guys an amazing deal if you go to ddpyoga.com/Austin right now. Give it a try. DDP Yoga changes lives. Just go to ddpyoga.com/Austin.
The following program is a podcast1.com production.
From Hollywood, California, by way of the Broken Skull Ranch, this is the Steve Austin Show.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Now, here's Steve Austin.
All right, everybody, welcome to Steve Austin Show. I am coming to you from the main streets of Los Angeles, California. My house, 316 Gimmick Street. I tell you what, swig a beer for the working man. I tell you what, I just got in from Dallas-Fort Worth. I've been over there for about 5 days. My wife joined me on Saturday, and we went down to the Texas Motor Speedway and watched the NASCAR race on Sunday, and I got a chance to announce the top 8 drivers in the Chase Cup Series. Hooking up with my old partner down there at the Speedway, Mr. Eddie Gossage. Eddie, was good seeing you again. Be a part of the Texas Motor Speedway family. Good time, man. Appreciate all the hospitality and everything you did for us. It was top-notch. I'll tell you what, man. It has been an interesting trip down there in Dallas. I was there for about 5 days, eating hotel food and drinking some local beer and local IPA beer, trying to get my workouts in. I'll tell you what, man. I went down to the gym one morning. It was a Saturday morning, and it was supposed to be a heavy deadlift day. I was trying to set a new PR, and I missed that PR by 10 pounds. And I think it was just because it wasn't on my normal system. But I got into a cab and got me a ride down there, and as I got out of the cab, I told the guy, I said, "Hey, dude, give me a card." So I got a number to call to get a taxi back to the hotel. So I completed my workout, 2 workouts actually, because I knew I was going to miss Sunday due to the race. So I was in that gym for about 2.5 hours getting my swell on. I go to walk out, figure, hey, I'll call the number on the card that the cab driver gave me. And I called it, and I called it, and I called it, and the voicemail kept answering it. I'm like, what kind of cab company is this? If they don't want to give nobody a ride, why have a phone number that nobody's going to answer? So I said, you know what? I said, I'm here in this city, but a country boy can't survive. I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive. Well, actually, I didn't have all those three things, but I did have my cold steel, knives, Swift, assisted open, pocket knife in my pocket. So I figured if anybody gives me any trouble, I'm ready. So I figured it's about a 2.8-mile walk back to the Hyatt Regency downtown from the Gold's Gym off McKinney Avenue. I figure, what the hell? I'll just walk it. So I started walking. Went about 3, 4, 5 blocks, and I was just chilling. Had all the time in the world. I figured if a cab happened to come by, I'd give them a whistle and jump in the car, and then just go from wherever the cab picked me up at. It was a beautiful morning, and I strolled by the Ritz-Carlton, and the dude, the bellhop guy, was coming up the ramp there, and, you know, most hotels have cab services. So I told the dude, I said, "Hey, man," I said, "y'all got cabs?" And he goes, and he says to me, "What's your last name?" I said, "It's Austin." He goes, "Yeah, man." He goes, "Let me go get the Ritz-Carlton car. I'll take you." I said, "Man, don't worry about it." I said, "I'll just get a cab." He goes, "No, I got you. Let me go get the keys to the car." So he comes around the corner in a GMC Denali, and I jump in, and he drives me over to my Gold's Gym. So I just want to say thank you to Justin over at the Ritz-Carlton, helping a brother out. I was happy to walk or catch a cab. We got over there to the Hyatt Regency downtown. I tried to tip the guy, and he said, "Steve," he goes, "man, keep your money. I just wanted to help you out." So thanks again to Justin for giving a brother a ride when he was walking the streets over there in the Dallas area. Along the way, when I was leaving LAX airport, I was standing in the security line waiting to go through the x-ray machine, and the dude who was right behind me, he walked up on me, and as soon as he did, man, that draft that he was bringing kind of just passed me up, and it smelled like, when I turned around, this guy weighed about 250 pounds, it smelled like 250 pounds of cigarette smoke and ashtray, all in his clothes, up in his hair, and man, you talk about a funky smell. I don't know if that dude was in his car, and he just smoked a whole carton of cigarettes, but he had to realize that the offensive odor coming off him was just outlandishly atrocious. So if you're out there and you listen to the podcast, hey, if you want to smoke, that's your business. But you ought to roll your damn windows down when you do, because, man, smelling like a cigarette or an ashtray ain't a good look, or really, in this case, ain't a good smell. And then, if to bookend that part of the story, as soon as I got on the airplane, it was a big-ass airplane, and there was only one seat left in first class. And I seen the dude sitting by the window. He weighed about 300 to 320 pounds. And I said, "Yep, I bet that's my seat." And it was. And this guy smelled like about 300 or 320 gallons of bad cologne. I tell you, people, whether you're man or woman, if you're going to go cologne or perfume, I'll make this family friendly. If you're ever in doubt, just use a frog's hair less, for Pete's sake. Just a frog's hair less. You got to consider you're going to be sitting next to another human being who might be offended by that smell that you're wearing. It might smell good to you, but for all practical, intrinsic purposes, I'd have had to flip a coin whether I wanted to sit by the dude to smell like too much cologne or the dude to smell like an ashtray. Holy smokes. What's that? Err on the side of caution, please. I tell you what, my wife's sitting over here next to me patting on the dog. She came down on Saturday, and they picked her up, and we went to the race together. She always likes to go to the Speedway with me. And y'all heard me tell a story a couple weeks ago. I lost my pocket knife. I walked up to the damn x-ray machine, and I always do this thing. I always start patting myself down. As soon as I patted myself down, I said, "Oh, man, I have my Cold Steel Swift on me," and that's an assisted open knife, and I just reached in my pocket and just threw that thing in the trash. Brand new knife, and my wife was coming down to see me. She was in LAX. All of a sudden, she got a little handbag, and they started putting that thing back through the x-ray machine once, twice, three times. Kristen, what happened?
Well, I couldn't figure out why the heck they were paying such close attention to my bag. So then the guy yells out, "TSA, bag check." So I have to go wait on the side. I waited, it seemed like 10 minutes. It was probably 5 minutes.
Were they doing this to you? You know, when x-raying your stuff, they're looking at the yeah, screen to see it, but then they look at you like, "What you got in there?" And they look back at your bag, and they look at you, and you're like, "Man, what I got in there?"
Yeah, they did. They kept on looking at me, and I'm thinking, gosh, do I look like
a terrorist?
I don't know what. I thought, geez. So then the guy finally comes over. He starts going through my bag, and I'm like, "Oh, I just realized what was in there, and it was the knife you gave me." So I said, "Dude, there's just I know what's in there. It's a small little knife." So he's digging through my bag. He finds a small little knife, and he looks at me, opens it up. He said, "Small?" I said, "Yeah, it's a small little knife." And he's looking at me. He's looking at the knife. He's looking at the blade. He's got little blue gloves on. He's wiping the blade, looking at me. And I'm like, "Can I just get on my way? You can have the knife. I'm not going to, mail it back to myself." I think he kept the knife, but he was looking at me like, why does this old lady have a knife in her bag?
Yeah, but he was thinking it's a pretty badass knife. But the way you told me, he was thinking, why does this chick have this badass knife?
Oh, a chick. Okay, I like that better than old lady.
Yeah, well, when you're giving me the unleashed version, you said a different word.
Yeah, I did.
So I'm trying to keep it clean. Okay. So you got your pocket knife, Jack. Now you were defenseless. You got on the airplane.
I was upset because I always get mad at you for always forgetting to turn in your pocket knives to your luggage before we get, you know, through the TSA. And I just felt like such a chump because here it is. It's turned on me, and I have to look like the idiot by telling you the story. Like, I got wrong.
I had to laugh at that one. I just gave that brand new knife, but at least you got popped, and I didn't. When, you know, I had one in my pocket.
So now it's 1 to 37.
1 to 37. You're still in the lead. I've lost way many more knives than that. But, hey, man, speaking of changing the subject, before I just get carried away here telling pocket knife stories and gym stories and needing a ride, we're just a few days away from the launch of Broken Skull IPA at the El Segundo Brewing Company on Friday the 13th. Swig a Beer Friday. Tickets are sold out for Friday night's event. But El Segundo Brewing is going to be selling and serving up Broken Skull IPA all weekend. So the Friday session is all sold out. But Saturday and Sunday, the gang will still be there selling Broken Skull IPA, filling up growlers, and selling all their badass beers. Mayberry IPA.
And you don't
need
a ticket.
White Dog. Don't need a ticket for Saturday or Sunday, but they're open for regular business hours. So check out El Segundo Brewing Company, 140 Main Street out there in El Segundo, California. Stop in and have a ice cold glass of Broken Skull IPA or any of the fine beers that El Segundo Brewing has. And we got some badass new T-shirts coming from ProWrestlingTees.com. I appreciate Ryan working his ass off to print up the T-shirts that we're going to be selling at the event on Friday. I'll try to get some extra shirts printed up for you people that are going down there on Saturday and Sunday. But anyway, without any further ado, Kristen, you got anything else you want to get off your mind other than you lost your pocket knife?
Well, I'm trying to get reimbursed for the bottle of wine that you didn't drink that you took out of the mini fridge at the hotel.
Yeah, so we're at the Grand Hyatt Regency at the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport, and you know they got those refrigerators, they got everything packed in there, and if you move something and take it out and look at it, you just bought it.
Exactly.
And so we checked out of the hotel, and then all of a sudden, well, we didn't really check out. We'll see you later. And then Kristen just got online, of course, to check out what was happening with the bill, and they billed us about $15 for a half bottle of wine. And all I did was take it out of the refrigerator, tried to put it back in.
He wanted to see what vintage it was.
Well, I just want to read about it, want to read the damn label, and they wouldn't charge me $15 for that.
Yeah.
Man, have a human being. How lazy can we get? Technology is great.
Yeah.
But, I mean, really, when you pull something out of the refrigerator, they're going to charge you for it automatically?
Yeah.
And one of these days, it'd be like going to the grocery store, and if you pick something up, you just bought it.
Exactly.
And that's an exaggeration, but there's just a little bit too much technology.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, one last thing, Kristen, before I get into this first read. Right there down at the baggage claim, I'll be damned if it wasn't TMZ down there waiting for us. Bill Goldberg. Bill Goldberg said that the beer that I was drinking in the ring, I wasn't actually drinking. Maybe I drank 5 or 10% of it, whatever his statement was. And I think he was being facetious because Bill Goldberg is a very good friend of mine.
Well, most of it spilled on your clothes.
Well, that's show business, Kristen. Oh. I mean, you know, I always say 50% went in, 50% went on. You know, the half that went in was for me. The other half that went on was for the crowd. That's called showmanship. That's putting on a show.
Oh, okay.
So 20,000 people or 68,000 or 100,000 can get, a visual. So, Bill, there was many times in the ring, and you weren't known as a drinker. I got you drunk in the ring, so don't be talking that trash and tell a true story. I was drinking and guzzling that beer towards the end of my career. I was drinking beer for a living and wrestling on the side, and I wanted to set that fact straight. I was out there drinking that beer, and if you didn't believe that, then you wasn't paying attention. Anyway, Kristen, you got any other stories you want to spin?
No, I don't think so.
Well, I appreciate you joining me here on the podcast. I'm going to unplug your microphone right here and now. Speak one more story or forever hold your peace.
Hasta la vista, baby.
All right. And with that, she says goodbye. And I'm going to jump into my first read. And I got to take a minute here to thank the great sponsors of this podcast. They are the ones who let me do this for free twice a week. And a big thanks to all of you for supporting my sponsors. And that includes Onnit. Onnit makes Alpha Brain. Y'all know that I take that before every podcast. Took it before this podcast because Alpha Brain and a Diet Red Bull, and I am good to go. I'll probably take a couple Alpha Brain on Friday night before I head down to El Segundo Brewing Company to sign posters for all you people who come to the big launch event for Broken Skull IPA. And actually, those posters will have already been signed. I ain't going to be sitting there signing a bunch of stuff. The posters and the stickers will already be signed. But anyway, Alpha Brain keeps me laser sharp, razor focused, and on it, and Alpha Brain can do the same for you. All you got to do is order it at onnit.com/Steve. And if you order it at onnit.com/Steve, you can get 10% off your order. In fact, you can get 10% off anything you order at onnit.com/Steve. And that includes Shroom Tech Sport and T+. Shroom Tech Sport will give your workout a boost. It helps you go longer and recover faster. It's made with natural ingredients, and it ain't loaded up with artificial stimulants. And T+ increases strength and power. It will improve your athletic performance. It's safe to use if you're competing. So go take advantage of this 10% discount off your order. Just go to onnit.com/Steve. And another great thing about Onnit and all their products is, if they don't work the way they're supposed to, you can get all your money back, no questions asked. Money back guarantee. So go to onnit.com/Steve to get your 10% discount off all your supplements. That's onnit.com/Steve to get 10% off your order. I know all y'all know about Uber. I'm sure you have the app on your smartphones and you've used Uber a time or two to get from place to place. But did you know the drive with Uber is a great way to make money? Just ask the next person who gives you a ride. I'm sure they'll tell you what I keep hearing. Drive with Uber is great because you get to be your own boss and you earn serious cash and you set your own hours. And it's really easy to get started driving with Uber. You just need a car and a license. Drive with Uber is a great option if you need flexibility in your work schedule. Like if you got kids, you can work around their schedules and their activities. You'll never have to miss another soccer game again. Drive with Uber is a great choice if you're a student. You can work around your class schedule. And if you're just looking to make some extra cash for the holidays or for an upcoming vacation, then you should drive with Uber. You just open up the app and you start giving rides. And when you're done for the day, you just close the app. You can work for a few hours or for a few rides. That's your choice. So now's the perfect time to cash in driving with Uber. You will thank me for telling you how to get paid every single week, and you'll thank me after you discover how easy it is to get started. And you'll thank me after you realize how much you love being your own damn boss. So you got a car, you got a license, put them both to work for you and start earning serious life-changing money today. Sign up to Drive with Uber. Visit driveatuber.com. That's driveatuber.com. driveatuber.com.
The Steve Austin Show. The Steve Austin Show.
All right, man, here I am, sitting in the church with Mark Lawrence, one of my idols. Back in the day, grew up watching you. You're a little bit ahead of me in age now. It's great to roll up on you, and I appreciate you giving me some time here at your church. How you doing?
Well, I'm great, but I lie about my age, so don't be talking this trash about me being ahead of you.
But you were. How old are you?
I lie about my age.
Okay, lie to me.
Turn all this equipment off, and I'll tell you, but I'm not going to sit here with it on.
Okay, I'm going to be 51 in December. Are you older or younger than me?
I am 56.
56.
And that's the honest truth.
How you feel after all these years? I mean, you didn't take any abuse in the ring, but man, you saw a lot of it. How you feeling at 56? Because you look just like you used to.
I would rather have abuse from the ring than I would in the church. And I've had my share, but I'm great. I'm as happy as anybody, very blessed, enjoying this stage of life. Don't look as young as I used to, but I still feel great, so rocking along.
Man, before we started turning on the microphones, you were talking about you know, how I ended up getting my name, and I gave that story. And then you mentioned the word kayfabe, and you said, man, kayfabe doesn't really exist anymore. But you said when you got into business, and this was one of my questions, you said Frisk never really smartened you up until after a year you got in. I know you started, you went to college at Texas Christian University. Were you born in the Dallas-Fort Worth area?
I was born in New Orleans, Louisiana, but my dad got laid off from Sinclair Oil Company when I was still in a car seat. And we came back to Fort Worth, and I grew up here.
Okay, now, you were doing the public announcing there at TCU, and you're also doing some calling some baseball and hockey games, correct?
Doing hockey. I hadn't started TCU yet, but was doing some work with Texas State Network and some other so-called anchor radio sports. But it was the hockey gig that got me the wrestling deal, because there was a big hockey and wrestling fan out of Michigan named Steve Harms. And he was the backup guy for then Scott Murray at Channel 5. And he's the one who called me one day. I was in my, it was in June of the year I should have graduated from undergraduate school, but I was cramming a 4-year program into 4.5 years and had to go back for another semester. So he called me that June, said there's a PA job open in the area. And I thought, gee, Texas Rangers, Dallas Mavericks, Dallas Cowboys. He said, are you interested? Sure. well, Fritz Von Erich's going to call you. And I thought, oh, no.
Did you know who Fritz Von Erich was?
I knew exactly who he was. I didn't realize he owned the promotion, but I had seen wrestling, knew of Bill Mercer, knew of his great history, but I didn't have any interest in or knowledge of pro wrestling, and I basically thanked Steve but was going to decline when Fritz called.
Yeah.
But as you know, that didn't happen.
Yeah. And you're going to take over Boyd Pierce's spot, who was going to go to Bill Watts' territory, correct?
Well, I knew that Boyd Pierce was a guy on television with the jackets that I later learned his wife made for him out of drapery material so they would be colorful on television. But I did not realize he was leaving. What I was told when Fritz called me is that they had an announcer, and he called him by name, but that he was going to Europe to sing for 3 weeks, and he needed a three-week sub. Now, in those days, the Dallas show was on Sunday night at the Sportatorium, and then we taped TV on Monday night at Will Rogers Coliseum. So it was Sunday, Monday, Sunday, Monday, Sunday, Monday for 3 weeks. But actually, my gig started on a Monday, so I've told you wrong. It was Monday, Sunday, Monday, Sunday, Monday, Sunday. So Fritz offered me what I thought was generous for a guy my age. He paid better than the hockey team. For 3 weeks, what have I got to lose? I needed the money, needed something to do, so I went and did it and found that the people were honest, they were fun, they were complimentary, they paid promptly, everything was on the up and up, and so after that third Sunday night, which was my sixth appearance, I thanked them and said, hey, if you ever need anybody else, give me a call. And they were all very gracious, and I went my way. And that next Monday, my mom was fixing dinner for the family out in West Fort Worth, and I went out there, got out there about 5 o'clock in the evening, and here is Kathleen D. White, Fritz Von Erich's secretary, looking for me, been dialing numbers. And she found me at my parents' house. There has been a mistake. We need you at the Coliseum tonight. So I ate quickly, went back to my apartment, quickly put on a coat and tie, headed for the Coliseum, and to this day, I never know what happened to that guy that went to Europe. Did he not come back? Did Fritz like me better? Or was it just a front that Fritz offered to try me out so that if I didn't work, he had an out?
Right.
I'll never know. But that's how it all started.
So the three-week gig turned into a 10-year gig.
Yes, sir.
Now, when you were at Texas Christian University, now they're a national powerhouse in football. Back then, not so much. What were you going to school for? To become a minister or
no,
radio?
I was a broadcast major at the time. And my first year to do TCU football and basketball, which was just public address in the stadium and the arena, was 84. And their horrible years of drought on the football field had kind of come to an end, and they were improved. They'd won 3 games the year before under F.A. Dry, and they just hired Jim Wacker as their coach. And this was Wack said it was F.A. had won 3 games the year before. Wacker went 1-10 his first year. And then he had the big year in 84 with some players out of South Oak Cliff, and they went 8-4 and went to the Bluebonnet Bowl. That was my first year as the PA guy.
Then did he go over to Southwest Texas and have all that success?
He came from Southwest Texas.
Okay, he came from, okay.
He stayed at TCU until Minnesota hired him, and he went to the Gophers at Minnesota and lasted several years. Then he died suddenly.
Right. Well, what in life made you want to be an announcer? You've always been very articulate, very eloquent. I like your style. And again, I grew up watching you. I'm not that far behind you, but you were the voice at that time. What garnered your interest in wanting to be an announcer?
Well, I was kind of a lazy, unmotivated student. I didn't like school, was shy, was always a skinny kid, had an inferiority complex. Broadcasting, talking, speaking was something I could do. And so I had confidence in that area. My first gig was volunteering to announce and narrate high school halftime shows.
Yeah.
Which is nothing. Nobody pays for that. I asked them if they'd let me do it. And that's how it started, and I had to learn to be a self-starter. And that's what carried me into the wrestling deal, because after the first year or so, Bill Mercer was gone a lot from the then-only show that we did it
right
in Fort Worth, because he was with North Texas Football and Basketball. He was teaching, had some other bigger gigs. And they were bringing in a guy who was a great, nice man, but he was awful. And so I went up to Fritz one night in the locker room and said, Fritz, I know Bill's got a busy schedule. How about giving me a shot at the TV? Because the thing is struggling with, and I call a guy by name, Fritz, that's exactly what Mark, I was saying, blah, blah, blah. And he sent me out that night to do a little color. And so I became Bill's backup for those 10, 12 nights a year that he was gone. And then, of course, the syndicated show emerged, and Bill moved to 39 in the Sportatorium. They moved Dallas to Friday night, and they gave me Channel 11 on Monday.
Okay, when you first start working for Fritz, you come in on this three-week gig. I mean, you're still a young man at TCU, right?
Yeah.
Okay, Fritz is a big, intimidating guy. What were your first thoughts when you met the man?
Well, I don't know that I met Fritz right off because he wasn't there every evening. He would be there sometimes, but he was beginning to phase out, and the production work had been done at the Sportatorium on Monday all day in the office. So Gary Hart, David Manning, Bronco Lubitsch were my main entrance people, and they would sit down and coach me through what I needed to get across that night. Fritz would just be in occasionally, but Fritz, yes, who was the big imposing presence, was always exceedingly kind, hospitable, and receptive of me. And he had this ethic that he wanted all of the boys, not just his boys, but all the so-called boys that worked in the office, to keep their hands off the announcer and have a degree of respect for the announcer. Now, they'd still yell and scream and be heels, but you lay off the announcer and you show a certain amount of respect for him, because if the wrestlers respect the announcer, our fans will too, right, and they'll trust and believe him. And it was a big deal to have Bill Mercer, because he'd done the Cowboys and the Rangers, had covered the Kennedy assassination for CBS. So he already had that in place, and Fritz lived that himself.
Then how was working with Gary Hart? Because I got a chance to work with Gary Hart on the back end of right before I went to Tennessee. He started running Metroplex Arena, running a little bit of opposition. And Gary was such a bright mind. I wasn't around him enough to really absorb all that knowledge. What was he able to how was he able to help you with regards to the message that you needed to get across when you were calling these matches? Because, I mean, man, you're doing what you said you were doing. You're doing high school football games, and you're volunteering. You've got a knack for it. But, man, with respect to psychology, the angles, the stories that need to be told, putting the heat on the heels and getting the sympathy on the babies, how was he able to communicate that to you so that you understood it?
Well, that's a good question, because even before the TV commentary, when I was just ring announcing, I was so green, they had to point out that this is Stunning Steve Austin over here in the red trunks, and this is Armand Hussein over here with the camel-toed shoes. Well, so they'd already learned to be patient, and Gary was an exceedingly patient man. He was a good teacher, and as you identified, he had a great mind for the business. He was a great psychologist, and he could read the crowd, he could read the angles, he could read the talent, and Gary was very patient when he would sit down and we would go through the night's card match by match as to what we had to get across. And as I learned the holes and learned the personalities, we developed a flow. Now, the other side of that was Fritz took me aside one night, one of those nights he was there. I'd been doing it about maybe 3 months, regular TV. And he said, Mark, you sound great out there, but you look terrible. And I started to say, I already know that, you know. There's nothing I can do about it. But what he was referring to is that I was trying so hard, and I was so insecure about this new world, that I was just stone-faced. I was expressionless. There was inflection and pacing in my voice, but expression-wise, when I was on camera, it was just, you know, so stoic. And he said, you're coming across as arrogant, and these people need to know you and like you, and you need to model what's coming across verbally, facially. And so he said, stand in front of the mirror and just watch yourself and do it. So I had to do those exercises to learn to smile.
But that's a very interesting point. I mean, how did you take that? I mean, because that's a heck of a critique.
Well, I took it constructively because he said it very lovingly,
yeah,
and he had my best interest at heart. So I learned to smile. I learned to nod. I learned to raise my eyebrows. I learned to wink. I learned to look away and look back. I learned to look down like I was concentrating, all those techniques. And as I did that, the fans were more comfortable in approaching me. And that's when I started giving kids autographs and hugging the grandmothers and developing a rapport with them. And I'll always thank Fritz for that.
At this point, you know, in your life, I mean, this is 1980s, and WCCW was really going to heat up, really 82 on for a while. But, you know, Kevin, I think, made his debut in 76. So it was already fairly hot. My question, though, is, okay, now you're starting to get the feel of things. You develop a relationship with Fritz Von Erich. You got Gary Hart in your ear. Wrestling's turned into a hot spot in Dallas, Texas. You had Mid-South, you had NWA. Because of what you were trying to do, would you watch anybody else and listen to the way they called matches? As like, you know, Ric Flair was an inspiration for me. Did anybody else inspire you? Because I've read that you liked Harry Carey, the great baseball announcer.
Well, before I answer your question, Ric Flair is a great guy. He was a prince. He had psychological gifts. Whenever he came to our office and he would come out for an interview, just as professionally as any great politician, he would compliment Bill Mercer or me or whatever, what a class guy you are, what an asset to this business, you know, blah, blah, blah. He just knew that he was a great champion. But back to what you were saying, no, I didn't, because we didn't have cable television. It was just starting, and nobody else's territory was at least available to me yet. It may have been to others. So I was learning as I went, but I did listen a lot to Bill Mercer. And so I learned a lot from him because I was sitting right next to him as he was doing TV.
Right.
And then I would watch him when he took the Dallas show. So he was the best example.
Was there ever any competition between you guys?
No, there really wasn't, because Bill was older. Bill never wanted what I had. I was picking up the crumbs behind him. He's a very genuine guy, so we developed a very good relationship. And it was just working. For him and for me.
When I was out there in the ring, of course, I was extremely green, but I was trying to watch a few matches back. Were you wearing headphones back in the day? Were they producing you from the truck? Was there anyone in your ear?
Yeah, they had headphones on, but very little was said, because that Channel 11 show was a low-budget operation. There was no post-production. There was no floor camera. You had a camera up on the truck, which was parked on the floor of the building, and one up on the edge of the balcony, so it was just back and forth, back and forth. So
I really tend to like that, by the way.
Yeah,
it's so simple.
It was. So they would tell me when to wrap the show up at the end, because it went off the air when they ran out of tape time, and we'd be right in the middle of a match. So very little was said. It was the new production out of 39 where we had lots going on, and we were hearing the director and take, you know, cut away and all this, that, and the other.
How did you adjust to that? I mean, it discombobulates me. Every now and then I'll do a podcast with WWE, and I get someone in my ear, and it didn't work so great for me. I'd rather just have one task, and that's to deliver my message. Were you good at multitasking once that started happening?
Well, I got the chance to come into that slow, because Bill took over the syndicated show with all these advancements, the lighting, the sound effects, the instant replay, the cameras on the apron of the ring. They're right in everybody's face. It was revolutionary for the business.
Cutting edge.
But I didn't have to be in the middle of that, because I was observing it just as the introducer of the wrestlers and the ring announcer. But then I was carrying ideas back to Channel 11 that I did not work for, because Fritz paid me, and said, hey, the difference between these two shows is making us look second rate. It may be worth Channel 11's while to invest a little more. Don't make Fritz pay for it, because chances are he won't, and see if we can upscale this a little bit and be more competitive. And Channel 11 realized that, and realized the rating opportunities that were in front of them as this business was burgeoning, and they brought in a third camera, an apron effect, and we began employing, to a lesser extent, basically copying what was being done with the 39 production under Mickey Grant and Keith Mitchell and those people who were behind all that.
Okay, I was about to ask you. I was going to bring up Mickey Grant because he was taking a lot of credit for a lot of the ideas that were going on back then. How close of a relationship did you guys have with respect to what you all were trying to accomplish?
Very little. I was clearly not in the inner circle of things as Channel 39 viewed it. Bill Mercer was their man. They had concerns about even having the formal introduction of the wrestler, which I was doing. They were thinking just an entrance and wham, run with the match. And Fritz was the traditionalist, still pushing the old introduction and the referee and 15-minute time limit. So they weren't unkind, but I clearly was not in the middle of the action. So that's how that relationship went.
You mentioned that Fritz paid you well over the course of 10 years. I would expect here and there you're going to go ask for more money. How was it? I'm not asking for dollar numbers, but I'm just, how was dealing with Fritz with regards to Heyman, his time for a raise?
Well, I never talked to Fritz about money, oddly enough. They would pay me $25 a night to go do the PA for a Fort Worth Texan hockey game. And that was a lot of work. It was fun, but you had three periods. You had penalties. You had goals and scoring and intermissions, and you got to walk out on the ice, you know, for the raffle for the car and Scoro and this, that, and the other. So it was an intense night, and you're live in front of everybody, $25. Fritz offered $35 to do the wrestling, which was easy. Well, when I started doing TV, that paid $100 a night. And old Joe Ranelli was a stockbroker in Fort Worth, big with the Miss USA pageant. He was a talent scout and coach for those girls. He and Fritz had gone way back in the old Ed McLemore days with the Moore family, when Fritz had bought out Ed McLemore, incorporated the Moore family into Fort Worth. And so Joe was part of extended family. And Joe's the one, without me ever asking, who would go say, "Hey, do you realize that Mark is doing a great job for you and your ratings are going through the roof? You don't need to lose him. And I know you're giving him $100 a night. Have you thought about," well, and out of the blue, it'd come to 125. And then down the road, it was 150. And then Bill didn't want to have to do the interviews for the syndicated show because it was monotonous. And they would plug those tapes for the fans that may not understand. The syndicated show was an oversized VHS tape that would literally be shipped via the mail around the world for any of the countries that paid for that right.
Yes.
And they could localize interviews for wherever the show was going to go, like San Antonio, Austin, Houston. And we would do all those interviews, Laredo, Lawton, Oklahoma. And those interviews would go on like for 4 and 5 hours during the day, just one after another, one after another. And so Fritz started paying me a flat rate to do those. So for part-time work, it turned out to be just fine for a kid who didn't know any better.
A big part of your career, you were a one-man show out there by yourself. But you know, later on, they'd put Frank Dusick, Percy Pringle, Terrence Garvin with you. Did you like working solo better? How was it, or did you like having someone to bounce things off of?
Well, I think it was a great learning lab for me to learn to relate to people by being out there by myself, because I had to be the describer of the action. I also had to be the color guy. I had to be the psychologist. I had to be the promoter for the upcoming events. And some of the guys would get frustrated with me because when in the course of a match, I had to stop and make reference to all these upcoming things, and they liked the attention on them, and I understood that. But it was fun. And I was the one-man guy, and I had to do the interviews and all this, that, and the other, but that was just the job, so I got used to it. And learning to relate to people and see them respond was a great thing, because it taught me a lot for what God had in store for me down the road that I wasn't yet aware of. And when I was dating, in fact, the woman I married in 91, we would go out in public, because we dated off and on ever since 87. And people would come up to us in public and sit down at the table with us. And it was just like we had known them and they were strangers, but they felt like they knew me, because I learned the art of being a little transparent about myself and would just let them into a little bit of me here and there where they felt comfortable with me, because I had to do that as that one-man guy to fill all the hats that I had to wear.
That was going to be one of the questions I was going to ask you down the road here, but let's get to it now, because people felt like they knew you. To me, you were a celebrity. So how did that impact your life? I mean, you were kind of a shy guy growing up. Now, man, all of a sudden, you're Mark Lawrence. You're on top of one of the hottest shows on television, a little bit of a rock star, if you will. And this is me putting you over. So how did that affect you? I mean, were you down with it, signing autographs, people coming up to you, hanging out with you and your future wife while you're trying to spend private time together in public?
You know, that's one of the areas of my life that I wish I could have back again, because I am somewhat of an introvert when it comes to one-on-one relationships or to have to mingle. When I'm on TV or when I was in front of the crowd in the ring or even when I'm preaching and leading worship, you have a certain degree of insulation and control because you're in charge and you're leading and you have an audience. And I've always been comfortable with that. But when I have to get out and mingle, that's when I become shy. And you mentioned when we talked on the phone that you were concerned that I wasn't too excited about meeting you. And that was not how I was feeling, but I can well understand how that came across, because I would be reserved or aloof or could be seen as disinterested or arrogant. It was just a shyness. So I had a terrible time accepting these people coming at me, because I struggle with attention deficit disorder anyway. So I was trying so hard to focus on what I had to remember, what I had to get right, that it was almost a distraction. And so many of these kids, so many of these people just needed a hug, a big smile. And I would give them the autograph and I wouldn't be rude. It's just that I didn't have the gift of hospitality that I wish I had to just love those people as one of them.
Gotcha. Hey, I've described the world famous Sportatorium many times. I'd like to hear your description of the Sportatorium. Maybe the first time you walked in it, or maybe what you remember of it.
Well, I was shocked the first time I walked in the Sportatorium, because it was a dump.
Okay.
I mean, it was a dump.
Agreed.
And but once you got in there and it filled with people, this electricity just began to emerge. And I always told the hockey people, you need an organ at Will Rogers Coliseum for those hockey games, because they tried to save money and not do that. Atmosphere almost means as much as what you've got going on in the ring or on the ice or on the court. And the Sportatorium had natural atmosphere. It was intimate. There was a steep elevation to the seating area, so the sight lines were great. Old asbestos ceiling. Half of it had burned and they just walled it off. So it had great atmosphere, and the concessions. I had an old gas flame popcorn popper, and that thing popped the best popcorn on planet Earth. They had the coldest beer in town, great deep fat fried corny dogs, French fries. It's like going to church. The regulars knew each other, yeah. So they congregated with each other. And it was just a place of incredible electricity. It was great for television, but it was infested with rats. First time I ever did TV, a rat, biggest one I've ever seen, just ran right over my head. It would attract cats because of the rodents, which occasionally would be under the ring when we started and get scared and emerge, you know. So it was a real interesting place.
Had an interesting smell to it as well.
Yeah.
Okay, the locker rooms were down stairs. You'd go in the door that I always went to, you hang a left. When I was in Chris Adams Wrestling School, I took a right and dressed in the janitor's closet. What was your office when you were doing your announcing? Were you upstairs?
Didn't have one.
So where were you?
Didn't have one. I would walk into what you saw at Will Rogers or at the Sportatorium and just basically float through back and forth and talk to the guys. When we sat down to go over things, that was in Fort Worth, and they had a table set up back adjacent to the locker room where Gary and I would sit, or later Ken Mantell. In Dallas, I wasn't doing all that much TV, but I would just go into the booker's office and just sit down with them, and they would go over whatever they needed to do, and the rest of the preparation was just out there with Bronco or Ed Watt. If you remember, they had some old airplane seats in there, like out of an old Convair or DC-3 that would still recline, yeah, that you could sit in. It was just a place, one of its kind.
Okay, now, I'm imagining growing up, you're a shy kid, a little bit ADD, you're at Texas Christian University, you're going to be a minister, which you are right now, all of a sudden you get in the sportatorium. You've got these heated angles. These heels have a ton of heat on them. I mean, okay, let's talk about the Von Erichs, because those guys were absolute rock stars back in the day, Mark. And you had to see some crazy stuff. And how did that affect you? Because you're caught up, and people can be pretty nasty in moments like that. Was anything shocking to you?
No. It was fun.
You took it for what it was? At that time, you said earlier, you know, before we started talking, the business was more kayfabe back in. When I broke in at the back end of 89 in Chris Adams Wrestling School, he didn't smarten me up. I knew something was up, but I'd almost bought in. So certainly, you know, as you were coming up, did you believe it was real from the get-go? I mean, at any point, suspend your belief?
I understood the gift of the exhibitional nature of the business. That's my nice way of saying it, because there's still some kayfabe in me. But I knew what I was into from the beginning, and I enjoyed playing the game of not being smartened up until they did. But once they did, they incorporated me into the family. They respected my views, my opinions. We had a good rapport, so it was never uncomfortable. And the excitement, the high spots, the intensity of it all were fun. They were exciting. I wanted to maximize that electricity. And the dark side that was going on behind the scenes with some of the alcohol and especially drug abuse, I was very sheltered from, because I was not traveling with the guys when they went other places. I got exposed to an issue with the Von Erich boys, and we flew to San Antonio one night, and they were just scared to death I was going to tell their dad. And I said, hey, don't worry. But I was sheltered from a lot of that, and I'm glad I was.
All right, I need to take a minute here to tell you how you can make your next car buying experience quick and easy and save a ton of money in the process. Here we go. Just download the TrueCar app. TrueCar has created a mobile app that makes buying a new car simple and fun. Download the TrueCar app, and in 5 minutes, you can create the car you want. You choose make, model, special features. Of course, you pick the colors, your car, and once you have your specs filled out, you can see what others paid for the same car. And when I say others, I mean people who actually live in your neighborhood and bought their car from the same dealer you're going to use. Then you can lock in guaranteed savings from TrueCar certified dealers in your area, on average over $3,000 off MSRP. So forget about the old way of buying a car, where you spend hours and hours at the dealer haggling with the salesperson over the price of the car and the options you want, and get with the new way of buying a car, where you use TrueCar and the TrueCar network of certified dealers who will honor your TrueCar savings certificate without any headaches or hassles. So download the TrueCar app and make your car buying experience easy. They got an app for everything these days, but how many actually save you some serious cash? Do the smart thing. Download the TrueCar app. Over 2 million cars have been sold by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network. Visit TrueCar.com or download the TrueCar app today and start saving. TrueCar, never overpay.
The Freebirds came in about 1982. Rizzo came in as baby faces, and you know, the Von Erichs were on fire. And then there's the heel turn in the cage match, and the door slamming, and you were calling that match. Describe that. What were your thoughts on the Freebirds when they first rolled in?
Well, they're obviously incredible talent. And one of the things that I always share when I'm asked over the years is the Von Erichs were the center of attention because Dad owned the promotion, and they had their gifts and graces. But we can't let their position overshadow the other incredible talent that came through there that made that promotion, because there were a lot of heels that came through there, in my opinion, had a whole lot more talent, both physically and psychologically, than those Von Erich boys. Now, David was good.
Yep.
Kerry had the body and certain acrobatic abilities. They all had their talent, but there was incredible talent through that office, and those Freebirds exemplified that. Three distinctively different personalities that complemented each other beautifully, and Hayes was such a great front man, PR man, yes, antagonist, obnoxious. He was just great. And people, even during the height of their heeldom, there were nearly as many people in there that loved them as they did those Von Erich boys.
I was paying my money. I was going to school at North Texas State University, and they'd been feuding for a long time. But I always tell people, and this is a true fact, Michael Hayes coming down that aisle, and he had that red sequin Confederate flag robe on. They were the Freebirds. He'd get on that second turnbuckle and start throwing his hair around and gyrating and doing his Michael P.S. Hayes thing. And it was worth the price of admission. And when the Freebirds went to get some heat on those on the baby faces, in many cases it was Devon Erics. I mean, Mister, they turned it on and the people got mad. And then you had, you know, Michael, who was so abrasive. And you had Terry, who was the heater. He was the bully. He was the big guy. And, of course, Buddy Jack Roberts, everybody thought they could beat him up because he was the smallest guy of the litter. But they were on fire. And to me, it was just it was a great part of professional wrestling, and it's still ingrained in my mind. What did you think, you know, in that cage match when the head got slammed in there and Kerry wouldn't cover Flair? And they turned heel. What were your thoughts? Like, hey, man, this is crazy. I mean, this is awesome. Because you were the voice. This was big business.
Bill was doing the TV that night. I was the ring announcer, but I was right there in the center of it. And that was truly probably the highlight of my entire career in terms of a crescendo of the business. I was asked last year when I went to New York for a different sort of interview what the defining moments were, and I said Kerry winning the world title in 80, what year was that,
84,
and the cage door incident. Yes. But let's face it, the thing with Kerry never would have happened had it not been for the cage door or the death of his brother.
Right.
So that cage door was an example of the most brilliant psychology and planning that forever changed the direction of that and gave it the chance to become a national and world venue that up to then it would have just been leading toward.
Who was booking at that time? Was that Gary Hart or was that Ken Mantel?
It's Ken Mantel. Gary left suddenly in about end of 82 or 83, and I never knew why. The indication was that Fritz had fired him. But in getting to know Gary then in later years when he came back, Gary had evidently quit because he was heartbroken. And that's the other side of Gary that we can get to when you ask about him. He had this great mind in psychology, but Gary had a heart of gold. He was a very kind, loving man with a fierce sense of loyalty. And if he liked you and trusted you, he was loyal to you and advocated for you, and you were his friend and he was your friend. But he expected that back from you. And when he didn't get that, Gary couldn't jive with that. He was heartbroken. He was angry. And when he had put his heart and soul into a big reunion ring of Star Wars, I think at Christmas maybe of 82, and Fritz had paid him far less than what he thought he deserved, Gary left. And Ken Mantell had already kind of been knocking at the door and talking to Fritz about possibilities. And all of a sudden, the change was made, and Ken had come in. So Ken was behind the scenes for the cage door and that burgeoning period that actually started under Gary.
Okay, you mentioned a little bit of a dark side or a black period here, and about to get into that. But before we do, how close were you to talent? Did you mingle with talent? Did they consider you one of the boys? Did you fraternize with them at any time at all?
They were all nice. We had a lot of fun. We told jokes. We processed the matches when it was over. But my relationship with them was just in the studio or just in the arena. Not traveling with them, not socializing with them, not going out to eat with them. So that was the extent of my rapport.
You know, I read that, you know, like I said, in that period in the early 80s and probably on through the late 80s, the drug use was pretty rampant going through there. And your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There was I need to be careful how I say this. There was a medical professional working in Southeast Dallas, had a wonderful wife, a drop-dead gorgeous daughter. They were all big in one of the big downtown churches, had connections with Fritz through that because Fritz went through that real religious spell. And this guy, through his medical profession, was able to get narcotics that everybody else couldn't get, you know. And he had some sexual challenges that caused him to be very attracted to Kerry Von Erich, who was very voyeuristic, would be in the upstairs area of the sportatorium, Fritz's office, Kathy White's office, loved to parade around in next to nothing, if not nothing at all, even with his wife there. And this individual wanted to be next to Carrie. He had some real issues there. And his ability to provide stuff for those Von Erich boys gave him that secretive inside track. And their brokenness was fed, his brokenness was fed, and I caught on to that, and it wasn't a pretty sight.
That's very unusual. Talk about David Von Erich. He died February 10th, 1984, at age 27. Word on the street was acute enteritis. Other word on the street was an overdose. Your thoughts on that?
You know, the story was never straight. I was still real new with him when he died because it happened early. I don't remember if I'd started TV or if I was still doing the ring announcing, but it all happened about the same time. And I was still teaching public school during the daytime. I'd graduated from undergraduate school, had not gone back to seminary, so there were 5 years that I taught school in there while all this was going on. And I remember David dying, and I remember all the stuff, and I remember going to the funeral up at Denton and the hysteria and the media event that it was. And I tried to talk to some people who knew or claimed to know, and I never knew what they were covering and what they weren't. Here's my take on it, and I reserve the right to be wrong. I think it is true that David died of the acute enteritis, which is a rupture of the intestine. I think that the circumstances that caused that had been induced by bad behavior. And had he not tried to mask the symptoms of what he was experiencing with more painkillers, he might have been able to get the help before it was too late. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's kind of a both and. One contributed to the other type situation.
Right. Then going a few more years down the road, you talked about some of the great talent that went through there for a minute there. Let's talk about Gino Hernandez. Because, man, here comes a guy who was awesome in the ring, but just so charismatic, good-looking guy. When he turned heel, I mean, people just hated his guts. And he ODs of cocaine at age 28. What were your thoughts on that? Because, man, when I heard Gino died, I was like, God dang, really?
There were a few occasions as I was maturing in life and gaining confidence in my position with the promotion that I wanted to reach out in a friendship way to some of the guys to be their friend. Gino was one of them. I remember I saw Gino at a Texas Ranger game one night. I was out there with my father and my grandfather because they had season tickets for the Rangers for years. And there was Gino, went to the Ranger game by himself. And that's rare because he's got an image and you have to protect that and be careful where you go and what you see. And here he is by himself. And that just told me that Gino was lonely. He had a hard time becoming vulnerable in relationships, and he probably had some of his own internal struggles. And I never did follow that urge. And Gino was always nice. We always had a great relationship. Of course, his birth name was Charles Wolfe. And to hear his struggle with cocaine, the sugar bowl, the awareness, but the lack of interest to do anything about it, the OD, the rumors that he was behind in his debts and there may have been foul play, all that stuff, made me so regret that I did not take advantage of the chance to develop that rapport. But that may be arrogant on my part. I may not have made any difference at all in helping Gino come to terms or peace with who he was. And I may have protected myself from something. You know, you just never know. But I always regretted that I didn't get to know Gino better.
I think Gary Hart, I read his book, I think, you know, he tried on several occasions to try to, you know, get him to, hey, man, straighten up or smarten up or here's what you're doing to yourself. You're heading down, you know, a one-way street and it's not going to end well. But obviously it did not end well. Out of all the Von Erichs, you know, I read that Mike Von Erich wasn't so enamored with being a professional wrestler, but was more or less, I don't want to say forced into the business, but he got into the business. I thought, you know, in reading some of the stuff I read, maybe he wanted to be a cameraman or be on the outside of the business. He goes over to Japan, injures his shoulder, gets a shoulder surgery, toxic shock syndrome, and he never really recovered after that. His body temperature went so high, he was just never the same. And so what was the word on the street back in the day? You know, on April 27, 1987, takes some Plastidils, goes in a sleeping bag, and he's OD dead at age 23. And, well, that one rocked me as well. What were your thoughts on Mike as he tried to struggle to live to the as he struggled to live up to the Von Erich name?
You know, that was a sad case because I think everybody was a loser in that. If you look at it objectively, almost callously, just from a professional wrestling perspective, Mike did not have the body, the size, or the charisma to come into that world where the Von Erichs are going over always unless there's foul play. It just discredits the whole thing. And if you then come on the other side of it from a humanitarian perspective, Mike wasn't ready. He might have been, you know, talking about religion for a minute, Joel Osteen, who's the great national voice out of Houston, was a cameraman for his father, John Osteen, with no intention of ever doing anything in terms of preaching or pastoral ministry, and his dad suddenly dies. Well, that says that in God's good time, things can begin to happen. Had they let Mike mature and grow a little bit, emotionally, psychologically, and physically, it might have been a better fit down the road. But forcing him in at such a young age, into that world, into the expectations, did not help him because he did not have a lot of confidence and he didn't have much personality. He was hard to get to know. And so it was a sad, sad deal to see Mike. And then the circumstances that you described. I remember going over to Baylor Hospital. They took us way up to the director's deal at the top that night when he was about to die, and Fritz was down on all fours in this prayer vigil. He didn't die, and that was a blessing, but he should have been given an honorary position to do something and not be forced to come back.
Do you feel like Fritz put pressure on all the boys to get inside the ring?
You know, I don't know that. Just the world they lived in would be pressure enough.
Right.
As far as how much pressure Fritz did, I just honestly can't answer.
Man, to me, I got a chance to watch a couple of Bruiser Brody interviews on YouTube. Probably some of the first shoot interviews which were ever done. And this is when Frank was being Frank. And he was talking about his background with respect to production and television and being able to produce shows. He just seemed like a really, really intelligent guy. How was your relationship with that guy?
Had a great relationship with Bruiser. You know, he never had any great single loyalty to any territory or office. He took pride in being independent. And then as the office began to really struggle, Bruiser was brought in to do some booking, and that's when we got close. I didn't like Buck Robley that he brought in,
right.
Had issues with Buck, but Bruiser and I had a great rapport. He was very affectionate. He was very complimentary. He was very passionate, but he was as rough and tough as anybody we had. You know, he never even laundered the garments he wrestled in because that stench, that smell was a part of his persona. And he was also a very shrewd businessman. He saved his money. He ate cans of tuna. He didn't go out and drink and spend. Took care of his family, took care of his wife. And I remember he took me aside one night and put his arm around me and just walked me into another room. And he said, "Mark, you know I love you, and you're not going to be doing this all your life." He said, "I just want to give you some loving advice." He said, "Don't ever put your position, don't put yourself in position where you waive the right to say," and he used the F word,
yeah.
F you.
Yeah.
And that was as sincere and loving advice as anybody could give anyone else. It's the way he lived. He kept that distance and that independence, and ultimately it made the guy mad that killed him,
right.
which was a horrible story, and the guy got away with it. But he was a great guy.
Skander Akbar told me the story one time when I was coming in, and he was telling me the Bruiser Brody story, and "How you doing, kid?" And obviously, you know, Bruiser was Bruiser, but Skander was Skander. He was older than Brody. And he goes, "You saving any money?" And Brody held up a bag of tuna cans. And he was indeed, you know, saving his money eating tuna cans. What were your thoughts when you heard about him getting cut in Puerto Rico? And like you said, the guy got away with murder. I mean, because, dude, that rocked the whole Dallas-Fort Worth area. It rocked everybody.
It did. And the Dallas office had already been through so much tragedy, you know, with the Von Erich boys and Gino and Chris Adams. And I don't remember the ordering of all that, but for Bruiser to go down overseas like that, under those circumstances, it was just almost haunting and violating and angering that that kind of stuff goes on in the world. But that's the world we live in.
What are your thoughts on Bronco Lubich? Because he was so helpful to me when I broke in. Him and Skandar, we'd go on a couple trips down to Louisiana. And he said, kid, who you riding with? And I didn't know anybody on the card. I was a pretty shy kid breaking in and green as heck. And so he said, why don't you just jump in the back seat with us? And I guess it was Bronco's Delta 88. It was a blue car. And I'd get in the back seat and we'd make the towns. And, man, I tell you what, it was like I was like a sponge, and they were just dropping in all this information, and I was asking a million questions. And those two guys are some of the most wonderful guys in that territory to me, because they took me under their wing and they helped me out. What was your relationship with Bronco and Skandar?
Well, Bronco first. Bronco had a heart of gold. He was a loving American citizen, loved that business, faithful husband, genuine guy. He didn't like a phony. But if you got in with Bronco, you had a true friend. He was a gentle spirit. He loved to laugh, took the business seriously, was a very integral part of the production and the carryout of the productions of that. Bronco was a great guy. And Akbar was one of the most delightful personalities that I ever knew in the office. He was aware of the world around him. He loved sports. He had a great sense of humor. He took an interest in other people, and he helped the career of so many wrestlers that he was looked to like a father figure. But he also had great talent himself, and his ability to come across verbally, psychologically, as a heel, obnoxiously, passionately, was outstanding. And he was top talent as well as being a top guy.
I was on Devastation Incorporated as one of the greatest gimmick names for a heel stable that there was. And he was very effective at what he did. To me, you know, when I think about all the Von Erichs, and I can't believe that, you know, Kevin is the last one standing, and he's over in Hawaii, and I know he's doing real good, and I know they just lost their mother. But Kerry, to me, seemed like he had the most star power out of all the Von Erichs.
Yes, after David. David was the one most like his dad.
Well, I always thought, to me, I mean, Kerry had that look, but I always knew that David was the worker of the family.
David wasn't cute and good-looking. Yeah. He was rough. It looked like his dad.
Yes.
Could have been the business mind behind the promotion had things been different. But in terms of appeal in the ring, not necessarily ability, but appeal in the ring, Kerry had the body.
Yeah.
The hips, the thighs, the chest, the biceps looked good in his suit with the white boots. Kerry didn't have the personality and the charisma to do interviews, but he could have a great effect in the ring, and he just had that body.
But yeah, those guys were just so good looking. If you go back, and I was watching, you know, I watched 8 or 10 matches last night. I mean, when you walk through some of those towns, whether it was Tarrant County Convention Center or Will Rogers or Sportatorium in particular, that the people were so close, they were so thick. Those guys were getting mugged going to the ring. And
yeah.
You know, Kevin used to tell me, I mean, there would be, you know, I know he's a happily married man, but I mean, people would, all the girls would be, as they pass through, pushing phone numbers in their palms of their hands. And last night I was watching one, and Kerry just laid a lip lock on one particular female who was right there and continued to the ring. But he was just on fire, and people loved the Von Erichs, and the guys loved them, and, of course, the girls all loved them because they were so good-looking. Kerry has a little bit of a problem. He has the motorcycle accident, tries to get up, walk too soon, and he loses the foot. Did the kayfabe you on the foot, too, because there was an oath of secrecy that no one was ever to find out about the foot?
For a while, I got the public line that he was injured, but surgery was going to repair it. And evidently, they tried to do that. But the circumstances that caused the accident, the second round when he got back with it too fast, that they were protective of that until I kind of caught on myself.
Chris Von Erich, the smallest of the Von Erichs, committed suicide. He was age 22, 1991. I just probably left for Tennessee. Maybe I was over in WCW. And I got a chance to work with Chris. Me and Percy were tag teaming up and able to do some things with him and Chris Adams. And, of course, you know, Chris Adams broke me in and helped me so much win Rookie of the Year in 1990 just because of the high-profile feud I was in with him. I heard about this young man committing suicide at such a young age. And then not too long after that, in 93, because of all the problems that Kerry got into, you know, went out to, you know, his dad's place and shot himself in the chest, and he was no more. Those two deaths, I mean, all of the Von Erichs except Kevin are gone. As you look back and try to put it into perspective, what went wrong?
Well, you know, little Chris had as much desire as any of those Von Erich boys. He wanted that position so bad. But his size just, it was the kiss of death for him. And talk about Mike being a credibility challenge, Chris really was. And no amount of cover, no amount of love, support, passion, packaging could overcome that. And not being able to live up to the expectations that Chris placed on himself based on that family ultimately got to him. And he was young, he was immature, there already been a pattern of brokenness in the family, and he made a very bad, very selfish decision.
Before we end, I know you gave me about an hour of time here. I want to talk a little bit about the Kerry Von Erich winning the NWA world title from Ric Flair on May 6, 1984. That was Texas Stadium, and that was the David Von Erich Memorial. Man, what was there? Was there 50,000 people there or 35,000?
Somewhere between 35,000 and 50,000.
That was it was a great match, and Kerry wins the world title. You were right there. What were your thoughts with coming on the heels of David's death? Here's the memorial. Kerry wins the world title.
Well, it's interesting because that was at Texas Stadium, taped by Channel 39 and the syndicated show. And here is this incredible event, and Bill Mercer is not going to be there. Like I said, he had lots of gigs, and I became his backup for the syndicated show when he was out, but I couldn't believe he was going to miss that. I mean, what else could you be doing that could top that? But for whatever the reason, Bill wasn't there, so it was going to be mine. So I had adrenaline and energy that day that just was made for that occasion. And so it was the chance to psychologically and theologically package. Now, I'm using modern theological language for my world now, but God is a God of resurrection. When life happens, there's always new hope when you trust God and move on. And that was the day to describe that without being religious. It was everybody's victory. Kerry was everybody's champion. Heaven smiles. You know, all that rolled right into one. So it was easy for me to do that day.
Your thoughts, I don't know if you'll remember this match, but you were the guy calling the action, and it's going to be my match of the week at the end of the show. On July 4th, 1983, at the Tarrant County Convention Center, it was a 2-out-of-3 falls match. It was the three Von Erich boys, David, Kevin, and Kerry, versus the Fabulous Freebirds, Michael Hayes, Terry Gordy, Buddy Roberts. And I think this match is about 35, 40 minutes long. And that crowd was on fire the whole time from start to finish. I mean, and you could hear the high-pitched shrill of the women's voices. And, you know, maybe some of them were cheering for PSAs, but, I mean, it was Von Erichs. And they really didn't have to do anything. And so many times when you do something in the ring, Mark, to elicit a response, it's a high spot and you step on the gas pedal and you hear that crowd rev. And that's the way that crowd was back then. And especially because the business was still kayfabe. And, boy, they loved the Von Erichs, and at the time they hated the Freebirds. And you were the one calling that action. I don't know if you remember that match, but if anything, you can remember at that point in time how on fire that territory was. And how much of a thrill was it for you to be able to call that action, which was premier? The people are just eating it up like cotton candy. And when a show would end, did you have the adrenaline rush like, you know, us performers in the ring?
Pretty much, because I learned that I couldn't sleep. Because I lived the first 2 years I did that literally about four blocks from Will Rogers Coliseum. Then moved into the dwelling I kept for the rest of the time, which was further out west in Arlington Heights, but then only 5 or 6 minutes away from Will Rogers. So I would go home after Will Rogers, and try to take a shower and go to bed, or maybe grab a sandwich and go to bed. And I lay there and couldn't sleep. And then I'd get up to go to work Tuesday morning teaching school, and it would be miserable. But yet on Friday nights, I would come home and I would sleep fine. And the difference was the drive home for that 45 minutes was the chance to decompress from the adrenaline that you're describing, which was wonderfully exciting, but it also made my job easier, because in those later years when it was waning, I started having to push and sell. It's like the difference between being a leader and being a pusher. It was easy for me to lead everybody through during those high years. In the later years, I was having to push, and it's hard work and not nearly as effective, because I can't, and no commentator can manufacture what can be done in that ring.
Was it your upbringing, your family life, your belief in God, your moral code? What was it that kept you from being caught up in the grind and getting caught in the wheels that so many of the boys got caught up in? Because you could have got caught up in those wheels. You were right there. You were around everything. You saw what went down. Was it just wasn't your cup of tea? You were able to give everything, if I say the Heisman stiff arm, because you could have been caught up in it. Did you ever get caught in it?
Part of it was the ethic that I described earlier about Fritz's respect for the announcer, which caught on, and so they kept me at a little bit of an arm's length, and so I was protected from that. Had I been thrown in the middle of it, I don't know what I would have done, but that was just adjunct from my relationship with them. So I never had to deal with it. I never had any theological issues. You know, even psychologists tell us that being able to vent human emotion in healthy ways is one of the greatest gifts towards psychological health. And that venting was so therapeutic for those people to come. And I'm not getting heavy on you, but when you can do that, it makes spousal abuse and child abuse and sexual abuse and so many other things diminish, because people can vent their anxiety in fun, healthy ways. Professional sports can still offer some of that. So I never had any problem with it. It was always fun. Fritz, you know, was always upfront about his faith. Channel 39 was owned by the Christian Broadcasting Network. So it was always an easy fit for me, until right at the end when Jerry Jarrett had bought it and I had started pastoring a church, and there began to be some conflicts, and that's when I knew it was time to say thank you.
How was that, riding off into the sunset? I left the business because of a neck injury, and I would have liked to have stayed around another 4 or 5 years. Were you ready to go? Because the guys in the ring never really have such a great exit strategy, and all of a sudden, here's your exit. Was it always part of your strategy to do what you were going to do?
It came about pretty fast. Jarrett had bought the promotion. It was clearly waning in many respects. In fact, we could not pull enough people at Will Rogers to sustain running the show over there on Mondays to do the tape, and the tape looked awful because the place was empty. So Jarrett continued running the tape on Channel 11, but he no longer let them tape it. He just used the little truck that he had bought that was doing the syndicated show at a much lower budget than 39 did, also taped the show for Channel 11. And he started doing it on Saturday mornings, and he just let people in free. And we got a good house that way. But it was hard to do the big show, TV, voicing, energy, till almost midnight on Saturday. I was living in Maypearl with my first church, drive down there, sleep a few hours, and come back the next morning. Jarrett had cheapened the promotion with the talent level, and the respect for the office of announcer had disappeared. And Jarrett had also reduced my compensation significantly, which I didn't have a problem with, but it was the psychological way that he went about it. He kept threatening me with having Frank Dusick for nothing, instead of just saying, "Mark, business is down. You're doing a great job. I'm going to have to drop you back. And if we take off again, you know, you'll be right with us." If he had done that, it'd have been different. But he had to play this psychological game with me that left a bad taste in my mouth. So all of these things combined helped me feel like it was time. So I gave my notice 2 weeks in advance. Jerry was not at the Sportatorium that night, and Jeff was in charge. And Jeff basically didn't say anything but, okay. And so I came back and did the next week. And then that following week was my day, and Jarrett was out again. And I made up my mind that I was going to leave as graciously and with as much class as I possibly could, because it had been a great chapter of my life. Everybody had been good to me. I even liked Jarrett, even though I didn't appreciate the way he'd approached that. I wasn't leaving because of that, and I liked Jerry. And so I did a very nice farewell to the best of my ability. They presented me with a plaque, which is hanging around here somewhere. I never look at my walls. And left. Unbeknownst to me, about 6 weeks later, Channel 11 pulled the plug on that show.
Right.
And I get a phone call from Eric Embry, who puts Jarrett on the phone, who offers me anything to come back. And I said, Jerry, thank you. I love you, but that's not why I left. It's not about money. It's just that I can't pursue this career, this calling, and continue to do that.
Right.
So that's how it ended.
Final two questions. I know you got to go. They tore down the Dallas Sportatorium in 2003. Your thoughts when you heard they were going to tear it down? Because it really kind of crushed me, because I had so many great memories there.
Yeah. It was sad. Of course, you know, Reunion's gone. Texas Stadium's gone, too.
Yeah.
The Sportatorium would have had to have had a loving benefactor who had money and who appreciated its history, who could have come in there and done enough rehab work to make it usable again. And that didn't happen. Other than that, it's an old metal building that had a heart.
You're right about that. It had a heart. But when they tore it down, and I can understand for all the right reasons, it was beyond repair. It had been burned up. But boy, I tell you what, it was such a special building to me, because I can still smell that building. I can still feel the atmosphere. I still remember that crow's cage where all the boys would sit up there and try to watch the matches when all the people got packed in there. And then last question, and please correct me if I'm taking you out of context here, but I read that maybe you said somewhere, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that you learn more in calling or commentating on professional wrestling matches, maybe with relating to people, than you did in the seminary. Is there any correlation there, or did you say that? Or
oh, that's absolutely
that help
true. Yeah. Absolutely true, and I'm very grateful for God's hand in my life in that. Seminary prepares you academically, theologically, biblically, cerebrally, but that world taught me how to communicate, how to relate, how to listen, how to love, and so many of the things that we talked about earlier, about what I learned from Fritz, what I learned from Gary, learned from Bill Mercer, all came from that aspect of my life. And I'm going to tell you something that you didn't ask about, but it deals with the Sportatorium here as we finish. I may be naive, but I really believe, with the way the business has gone, with first it was McMahon and Turner, and then it became mostly McMahon, we've lost the regional territories. We've lost the farm system for the major leagues.
Yeah.
I really believe that if somebody came along in this part of the country and could rebuild a structure similar to the Sportatorium and had the seed money for the early years when you weren't going to make money, but could start over again and rebuild a promotion with top young talent, good production, bring back kayfabe, I honestly believe there's a future out there. And I've often dreamed, if that occasion came along, that I'd like to have a chance to be a part of it. Here now that I'm, 56 years old, probably never going to happen, but I really think it could.
I believe that I don't think that you can ever bring kayfabe back, but I think you can present it in a realistic shoot fashion, because sports entertainment, quite frankly, is basically sports turn entertainment, because you're predicting the outcome. But everything else in and of itself is real. It's manufactured, but it should look and feel real. So if you present it in that fashion and not too over the top, I agree with what you're saying.
Yeah, look at UFC. Look what's happened in the National Football League, how that has changed from the days of Tom Landry and his derby versus what we see with the antics on field and off field. The world has changed, and I think there's a venue for it.
Mark, what do you have? What do you do for any kind of hobbies? You mentioned your ADD. I think I am as well. I have a hard time reading. Obviously, you must do a lot of reading. Do you have any hobbies?
Well, That's a two-pronged question. The reading pertains to my vocational stuff.
Yes.
I've never been a great reader, but I made it through seminary, and I've been in ministry for 25 years, so I obviously get enough reading done to get by. But the advent of the Internet is a great tool for me vocationally in what I do. In terms of hobbies, I'm a single-parent father. Marriage has not been kind to me. I've had two disappointments in marriage, and I have two wonderful boys. So between running a 1,000-member church with 400 people on Sunday and being a single parent for two boys, one of whom I have most of the time, the other I have some of the time, I stay busy. But hobby-wise, I've always been a great rail buff. I love to travel by train. I keep up with passenger trains. Railroading gets in your blood. You know, there's rail conventions all over the country. So that's been my main hobby. I need to get back on the golf course, but I haven't done it in several years. In fact, it's been more than several. It's been like 20, but that's on my agenda for next year. So I stay busy, have a lot of friends, have a lot of fun, and that's my world.
Do you watch any of the current wrestling product at all anymore?
I don't even know who the talent is. It was embarrassing. I did a fan fest in New York City last year. I alluded to it earlier when they did an interview with me and Bill Mercer. Really had to be brought up to date on the angles and some of the talent. It was great fun, but when I finished with Jarrett, I finished because my world was focused in other areas.
This is my last question, I promise you, because you said 1 hour.
That was an hour ago.
I know.
I'm just teasing you.
If you had to pick one, people always want to ask me, Steve, what was your favorite moment? What was your favorite WrestleMania or whatever? Is there a favorite moment that you had in your with regards to your pro wrestling career?
There is not a single favorite. There were just so many great occasions that made that so special and so much fun. And it's not only the excitement and the success of that promotion during its heyday. It's the crazy stuff and the fun stuff. It's Skandor Akbar coming up and sitting down next to me. We're great friends, but he is just antagonizing everybody, and he grabs the microphone and starts yelling at the fans through me, and his chair collapses, and he falls to the ground.
Yeah.
And Bronco Lubitsch looks straight at me, and we know we can't look at each other. We can't get through it. It is just too funny, and we've never forgotten that moment. It's Akbar grabbing the house mic with the biggest, largest, dirtiest woman, beehive hairdo, sexually inappropriate objects that she's brought with her that she's using on the wrestlers. And he grabs the house mic and just says, "Ladies and gentlemen, here on the very front row, it's Mrs. Mark Lawrence here at the arena tonight." And he's all doing that for me. And you might think that the old gal might be flattered, but she's not. It's F you, she hollers. And, you know, just it's just those priceless moments of fun with those guys that I'll always with. Arman Hussein, he used to have my number, and he knew it. He had timing. He had pacing. He was a stand-up comedian. We just had so much fun. Those are the great moments I remember.
Mark, it's good to see you after all these years. I think it's been 25 years, give or take. I was able to, I don't want to say track you down, but locate you over here at the church. Do you do any appearances? Do you do anything that we can talk about and promote?
I did the deal in New York last year that I mentioned to you. That was fun. They flew me and Bill Mercer, who lives in Durham, North Carolina now, to do this thing you can see on YouTube. It's called Voices of World Class. I think you have to pay for it. And we did a fan fest. There is a little promoter, kind of a disorganized little guy. It was real nice, out of, I think, Galveston or Houston, that has done these Coastal Mania productions. He did one of those up at the Mesquite Rodeo Arena, and the Von Erich boys, Ross and Marshall, came up here with Kevin, and I went over and did some ring announcing for that, but there wasn't anybody there.
Right.
It was very poorly promoted. Just some publicity about this Von Erich rally could have brought a couple of thousand people anyway, if not more, but nobody knew about it. And then there's this promoter over here out of Crowley, this kid named Fuller, who's done some things that I helped him with, just mainly for fun. So that's the extent of it.
Are you on Twitter?
No, not on Twitter. There's Wikipedia, there's YouTube, but not much on Facebook because I'm not on Facebook. That's pretty much the extent of it.
Well, Mark, I appreciate your time. It's good connecting with you again. It's good to see you. And I was a big fan of your work way back in the day, and it's always good to see one of the guys who came out of the other side, obviously totally unscathed because you never got any of the bad stuff, but so many of us do. It's good to see you, and obviously good to see you in such a good place.
Well, and I hope I'm not as arrogant as I came across 25 years ago and am more upfront and down to earth.
Thank you very much, Mark.
This week on the Big Podcast with Shaq, we're joined by the best player in the NBA today, reigning league MVP, Steph Curry.
Steph Curry, I'm your biggest fan.
I knew I could play in this league right away. I knew I could, you know, help a team win, be a championship point guard. It's something that I've always aspired to do.
You're just so cute, and you're just so huggy, and you're just so snuggly.
I got a killer instinct, too. I just tell people that I like to do it, having fun, smiling. I know I got a youthful, I call it a youthful look. I don't want to call it cute.
Yeah, you are cute. You're like a little baby. I want to just pick you up.
The Big Podcast with Shaq.
That's me. It's up right now at podcast1.com.
All right, gang, give me the go-home cue. It's time to wrap up this podcast and ride off into the sunset. I want to thank my guest today, Mark Lawrence, for letting me come over there to his church and spend an hour, a little bit over an hour of his time with me, talking about the old days from World Class Championship Wrestling. It's good to see Mark after so many years. He looks like $1 million. He sounds like he's in a good place. I appreciate him giving me some time. It's awesome catching up and telling some old stories. And speaking of old stories, I got a match of the week for you. And the match of the week is July 4th. 1993, Tarrant County Convention Center, 2 out of 3 falls match with David Carey, Kevin Von Erich versus the Fabulous Freebirds, Michael Hayes, Terry Bam Bam Gordy, Buddy Roberts. This crowd is totally on fire from start to finish. If you get on YouTube, just put in July 4, 1983, Von Erichs versus Freebirds, Tarrant County Convention Center, 2 out of 3 falls. And Mark Lawrence is calling the action. Now, you talk about a crowd that is totally on fire. This is that crowd. And it seemed like that whole territory at that time was, every time you went out, the shrill pitch of those women in the audience, and the guys were going crazy, too. The Freebirds had a ton of heat. The Von Erichs were over like rock stars, and it was just a real badass time. But anyway, that's the match of the week, and I appreciate you guys, you know, listening to the podcast twice a week. And once again, to those people coming down to El Segundo Brewing Company on Swig a Beer Friday, the 13th, we got those 3 sessions, and all the posters, the stickers, the glasses, everything will be given out. It's going to be a good time. If you can't make the Friday event, Saturday and Sunday at El Segundo Brewing Company, 140 Main Street in El Segundo, they will be filling growlers and serving Broken Skull IPA along with all the badass beers that they already make. So if you're in the area, go give that place a try. Go get you a growler full of Broken Skull IPA. And let me know your feedback at questions@steveaustinshow.com. If you're a light beer drinker, it'll take you a while to make the swing, so it might not be up your alley. This is a badass 6.7% alcohol India Pale Ale, and it's a damn good one in my opinion, but my opinion doesn't matter. It matters what you think. So if you're a hophead or you love IPAs, go down there and give it a try and give me your response on questions@steveaustinshow.com and let me know what you think. Hey, man. I got to thank all my sponsors of this show who let me do this for you for free twice a week. So big thanks to ddpyoga.com/Austin. Tweet your DDP Yoga story to Podcast One and use the hashtag Steve Austin for your shot at winning an autographed copy of the DDP Yoga program. Tweet your DDP Yoga story to @Podcast One and use the hashtag Steve Austin for your shot at winning an autographed copy of the DDP Yoga program. On It. Get 10% off your order at onit.com/Steve. True Car, Uber, and big thanks to Amazon who've been supporting this podcast since day one. Hey, folks, if you want to help this show out, I ain't asking for handouts. I'm not asking for your money. But if you want to use our Amazon links because you want to help the show out, I sure would appreciate it. All you got to do is go to podcastone.com. Click the Support Our Show sponsors banner. Then click on the Steve Austin Show. All of my great sponsors are there. All of my Amazon links are there, too. Amazon kicks back a few bucks to the show every time you use one of those links. You don't have to buy anything special. There are no extra charges or hidden fees. But whatever you are planning on buying, Amazon will kick back a small percentage to the show to help us cover our production cost.
if you bookmark this Amazon link that goes through steveaustinshow.com via podcast one, it would help a brother out and make it easy on yourself to find it at one click. Until next time, folks, my name is Steve Austin, and I will catch your ass down the road.
This has been a Podcast One production. Download new episodes of The Steve Austin Show every Tuesday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.
I want to say thank you to Drop Stop, one of the great sponsors of this show. Drop Stop is the original patented seat gap filler, as seen on TV Shark Tank. Get the original Drop Stop at buydropstop.com and use code STEVE for two free gifts and free shipping. Stay tuned for the latest AP news headlines from Podcast One right after this.
AP Update, I'm Ross Simpson. The president and the leaders of Southeast Asian nations called today for peaceful resolution of the region's maritime disputes as they concluded a summit in Southern California. President Obama told a news conference that disputes must be resolved by legal means, including a case brought by the Philippines that challenges China's sweeping claims over most of the South China Sea.
The United States and ASEAN are reaffirming our strong commitment to a regional order where international rules and norms and the rights of all nations, large and small, are upheld.
During a question and answer period with reporters, Obama reaffirmed his constitutional right to nominate a successor to the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia.
There is more than enough time for the Senate to consider in a thoughtful way the record of a nominee that I present and to make a decision.
I'm Ross Simpson.